From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This year, Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and tonight, public television is showing a tribute to the show's creator and executive producer, Lorne Michaels. It's a broadcast of the Kennedy Center ceremony in which Michaels received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lorne Michaels about creating Saturday Night Live. Also, what makes the perfect pizza? We talk with food writer Ed Levine about his new book, Pizza, A Slice of Heaven. And TV critic David Bianculli considers two David Milch creations, NYPD Blue, which ended its 12-year run last night, and Deadwood, which begins a second season on HBO this weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. My guest, Lorne Michaels, created the show and is its executive producer. In October, he received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor in a ceremony at the Kennedy Center. That ceremony will be shown as a 90-minute special this evening on public television. It will feature clips, tributes, and performances. Lorne Michaels has been with Saturday Night Live for all but five of its years, 1980 to 85. He produced many movies with performers who got their start on the show. Here's a sampling of the past 30 years of Saturday Night Live.
Hi, I'm Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night.
Good evening, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not.
Now, a lot of people thought my last program was pretty quummy. Well, this one's truly quammed with quibble revelations, rapport, and repartee.
We are two wild and crazy guys!
But no!
Jane, you ignorant slut.
I am dark and you are light.
You are blind as a bat, then I have sight.
I am Hans.
And I'm Franz.
And we want to pump you up.
Wayne, do you want to play Truth or Dare?
Truth or Dare? With me? No way.
Way.
No way.
Way?
Excellent.
Because I'm good enough. I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Paul Newman's half Jewish, and Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together, what a fine-looking Jew.
You're gonna be doing a lot of doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river.
You T-L-Y, you ain't got no alibi, you're ugly.
We can update. I'm Jimmy Fallon.
I'm Tina Fey. Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow.
Saturday Night Live is now the same age that Lorne Michaels was when he created the show, 30. I spoke with him about how the show began. Why was it important for you for Saturday Night Live to actually be live?
I think the most important reason at the time was that we wouldn't have to do a pilot. I had worked on enough pilots, three with Lily Tomlin and with a bunch of other ones where when the way people talk themselves into things or the way that overthinking works is you say, well, you know, when we're on the air, we can make do different things. But now we just have to get on the air. And so you tend to want to please and you tend to do things that have already been done because that's the way you're guided. And I thought if I could sort of get straight to the audience, if I could just do the show that I wanted to do and put it on the air, I thought there'd be an audience for it. And being live, the danger which I didn't fully comprehend at the time, I'd done enough work on stage that I wasn't worried about that part. And also live audience was, you know, I knew would be exciting. But there was the idea that the whole country would see it at the same time, including the people at the network, who, while supportive, had bigger problems than what we were doing in late night. You know, they had a primetime schedule to worry about. So we were left alone, and also we were in New York, which there wasn't much production in. So we were kind of not on the radar or whatever technology was dominant then.
The way the legend goes, John Belushi had said to you, I don't do TV, because he didn't like TV. And
that's
that
true.
You didn't get along, you know, at first, you know, there's this kind of like chemical difference between the two. So how come you hired him?
Well, what happened was I was fairly serious about things then. And I think I thought there was this little window of, you know, that we could maybe climb through and try and get the show on television in a way that was pure. And so I wanted people who were completely committed. And I think John, who I think was completely committed, came into our meeting and made the point, which was a kind of backhanded compliment to me, that he didn't do television, but that, you know, sort of what I was doing was the exception that he was prepared to make. And I didn't want anybody who had any ambivalence. So I just said, well, if you don't do television, that's all right with me, because this is very much a television show. Also, people really looked down on television then. It was just thought it was too big a medium, too mass a medium, and I think people, it was looked down on. So, and I thought, having grown up watching television and loving television, I thought, well, I don't want anybody who's A, doing me a favor, and B, not completely committed to this. And I think John had really just misspoken. It was a sort of, it was just one of many, many meetings with lots of different people.
I want to read you something that Dan Aykroyd said in the book Live from New York, which is the book Tom Shales wrote, like a kind of oral history of Saturday Night Live. And this has to do with the liveness of Saturday Night Live. He said,
right.
I once got mad and put a hole through a wall in Lorne's office. I punched a hole in it because I was so mad at the way he would give us last-minute changes before air. We would have to run down and give them to the cue card guys, and they would be going crazy and saying, are you kidding? You want us to get this on? So how do you deal with it when somebody in the cast puts a hole through your wall? I mean, when their temper just gets so out of control that it actually does physical damage.
It was there was a fair amount of volatility in that period of the show, but I think it was much more to do with all the changes that were swirling around us and that sort of intoxicating brew of fame and celebrity and money and power and all that, which was new to everyone there. It's not that way now.
People don't have tempers like that now?
No. I can't vouch for everyone, but I'd say that first period, or at least the period between around 1977, 78 was really the period that Danny's talking about. Because up to that point, it had a very strong all-for-one, one-for-all quality. And I think that changed when the opinion of the show changed.
And then everybody got really famous and...
Well, I mean, I think people... There was a little bit of a gold rush quality to it, and I think there was... and it still was, and still is, physically really hard to get that show on every week. I mean, we go from blank page to on the air in 6 days. So, and with a different host each week, which is a whole different set of writing problems. So writers and performers are working side by side. There's designers, there's musicians, there's filmmakers, there's a whole, and all of them tend to see and experience the show through the prism of their own experience. If their piece got on, they really liked the show last week. If their piece didn't get on, they didn't think people really liked that show. So it's a very intense process, and it can be bruising. It also is exhilarating, and or else it wouldn't. People wouldn't still be there doing it.
You know, from reading about the show, it sounds like one of the things that separates the first cast from subsequent casts is that the first cast, people were very close, and then people were sleeping with each other. So you have all these, like, professional competitions and jealousies mixed in with, like, romantic competitions and jealousies, and that's, whoa,
yeah,
what a brew.
I tend to think all that's a little
overstated.
But it made for excellent reading,
and people
are curious about it, and I think it's right. It's great. But that wasn't what was the determining thing in the show. I think everyone at the beginning of the show was unknown.
Right.
Everyone.
Right.
You know, and that meant the writers were unknown. People had tiny followings, I suppose, but on terms of a national level, no one was known. And then people became known and famous, and the impact of it was, more overwhelming. And I think that altered people's relationships, both with each other, their friendships, their, in some cases, marriages. I think it was, you know, that nobody had ever done it before. I think it's much clearer now what sort of happens, and I think people know what it is.
My guest is Lorne Michaels, the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live. Tonight, PBS will broadcast the tribute to him that was held at the Kennedy Center last October when he was awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorne Michaels, and he's the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is celebrating its 30th season this year. You've said that the value system that was around at the beginning was, as long as people showed up on time and did their job, it was nobody's business what they did in their bedroom or in their lives. And you said that value system turned out to be wrong.
Well, I think that we were what somebody older than me used to refer to as my pseudo-egalitarian value system, or the way I ran the show on that on that level. But I think that you just don't know. It starts with the core thing, which is the comedy. No one knows for sure what's going to work, what's not going to work. So no one has – there are people who are more experienced and therefore maybe listen to more. But at the end of the day, if the apprentice writer has a better joke than the senior writer, well, you have to go to the best joke. You have to go to the piece that involves building a ship, you know, that costs a lot of money didn't play, but the piece where the person sat on a chair worked perfectly. Well, you can't think of anything other than what's working. So that's people are up and down in that value system all the time. And I think that's that turbulence, which I like to think of as a sort of creative turbulence, is the defining thing of the show. You're always somebody who shouldn't emerges as the most interesting thing that week, because it's not ordained. It's just sort of we go in always long, and you don't, until that audience comes in, you really don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work. And I think that what was going on in the 70s nationally was, I think there was a strong fear of the government in the bedroom. I think there was a strong fear of too much, you know, this is right after Watergate. There was, and the Vietnam War. So I think there was a sort of new freedom, and we were testing the limits of it. And I think that what I believed then was that you didn't have responsibility. It wasn't your business. Therefore, it wasn't your responsibility. And I think that turned out to be wrong. We just didn't know enough.
At some point, did you feel that you were the executive producer, so it became your business to draw the line, even in people's personal lives, if you felt it was interfering in some way with your work on the air?
In the first 5 years, I wasn't executive producer. I was just producer. And that lofty title didn't exist. But I think that we were all the same age. We were all friends. We all came from, you know, approximately the same kind of place. And so I wouldn't have... In the same way that when Chevy was leaving, he and I talked mostly as friends, much more than as producer, cast member. We, you know, whether or not it was the best thing for him to move on was much more about what would be best for him than it was, hey, come on, I think that it was fraternal. And I think as the years went by, I realized that more and more people looked to me in a paternal role, which was shocking to me because I was 31. And I think that when the same thing happened, for example, in the late 80s, when Chris Farley got into trouble, at the very first sign of it, you know, he was in rehab. Whereas I think when John Belushi was getting into trouble, it was hard to tell what was being on the cover of Newsweek and starring in Animal House and what people's limits were, what people could handle, or what was, you know, because it was all I hope I'm not sounding defensive on this, but I think most of what happened to people that was destructive happened away from the show. In the case of John Belushi or the case of Chris Farley, it happened years after they left the show. And I think that the discipline of actually having to get that show on every week and of letting down your fellow cast or the writers, there was just always been too much of a standard there and too much of a work ethic for people to screw up there. I think, you know, you finish a show at 1 o'clock in the morning and there's... you. an enormous amount of adrenaline's gone through your system, and you're not ready to go to sleep. And so people go to a party, and sometimes people want to, you know, obliterate the recent past or whatever. And I think, you know, it was all sort of uncharted territory then.
Well, you know, let me read you something that Bob Odenkirk, who had been a writer on Saturday Night Live, something that he said in the book Live from New York. He says, the greatest thing I ever saw Lorne do was the way he wound up treating Chris Farley. I think Lorne was determined not to have what happened to Belushi happen to Chris on his watch. And it seemed to me that Lorne very seriously put it to Chris, every time Chris messed up, he had to get cleaned up before he could come back on the show. Lorne really made Chris think about what he was doing, because the most important thing to Chris in the world was performing on that show. That was the goal of his life, and Lorne knew it. And Lorne took it away from him multiple times and forced him to go to rehab.
Yeah, I think that, well, it's so. But I think it was, we just knew more. You know, people would, you know, you'd see people in the 70s at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they'd, you know, look fine. Sometimes they wouldn't look fine, but I don't think anybody ever saw anybody in trouble and walked away from it. I think it was, you know, the next day we had a show to do, and people showed up, and that writers' meeting, which is on Monday, is the same now as it was then, and people had to show up for it, and they had to come prepared with an idea or two. So I think when people got away from the show and didn't have the structure and the discipline that the show demanded of them, I think people got into trouble.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking that it sounds like you really intervened in a positive way in Chris Farley's life when he was on the show.
Yeah, but and we did with John Belushi, too, multiple times. It's what I'm saying is that in the show was a caring environment. You know, it isn't like you want to see anybody get in trouble or you're aware that anybody's in trouble. I think that the sheer fatigue of in those days 4 shows in a month was, you know, people were bleary-eyed, people were exhausted, and people were still going on and doing the show. And I think that people who were used to that level of excitement, that level of whatever, when they suddenly left, people tried to get it in different ways, I think.
I have to say, it must be exhausting for you to have to oversee a weekly live show and also take some responsibility for helping people who are having trouble in the cast.
Yeah, I think I'm certainly better prepared to do it now than I was then. I think it was more, you know. It's glib to say we were making it up as we went along, because I think we were more sure-footed than that. But I think there was so much we just didn't know. And then I think even we didn't even know that there was a much of an audience reaction to the show till this first summer, because we were always there. And New York City was moving along quite well without us. So it was only when we got out into the country that you realized people were actually watching the show. Because up to that point, you just sort of hear about it from your friends or your family, but we had no idea of the impact of it until I think Danny and John drove cross country and you know in that first break we had in July of 76, and they were amazed that, you know, John came back and said, people really love that samurai thing I did, and at that point we sort of had a rule about doing anything twice, and John was, you know, a prime proponent of that rule. So he was sort of taken aback when people went, when are you going to do it again, you know?
Lorne Michaels is the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's hear a Chris Farley sketch, The Chris Farley Show. Farley plays an inept talk show host who's more nervous fan than interviewer. In this edition, his guest is Paul McCartney.
You remember when you were with the Beatles?
Yeah, sure.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Okay. Oh. You remember when you went to Japan and at the airport they arrested you because you had some pot and made all the papers and everything?
Well, to be honest, Chris, I'd kind of like to forget all that.
Idiot! So stupid! What a dumb question.
No, Chris. I get asked that all the time in interviews. Maria Shriver asked the same question last week.
Really? Did you know that she's married to Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. Did you see Terminator?
No, I missed that one.
Yeah, that was a pretty awesome flick. Okay. Okay, you remember when you were with the Beatles and you were supposed to be dead and there's all these clues that, like, you'd play some song backwards and it'd say, like, Paul is dead and everyone thought that you were dead or something?
Yep. Yeah.
That was a hoax, right?
Yeah, I wasn't really dead.
Right.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Lorne Michaels, creator of Saturday Night Live. Also, we talk with Ed Levine about his new book, Pizza, A Slice of Heaven. And David Bianculli reviews two shows created by David Milch, NYPD Blue, which aired its final episode last night, and Deadwood, which begins season two this weekend on HBO. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lorne Michaels, the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Tonight, PBS will broadcast the tribute to Michaels held at the Kennedy Center last October when he was given the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Michaels insists he's not comfortable in front of the camera, but he's made some memorable appearances on Saturday Night Live. Here he is in 1976 trying to convince the Beatles to reunite and perform on the show.
Now here it is, as you can see, verifiably, it is a check made out to you, the Beatles, for $3,000. All you have to do is sing three Beatle tunes. She loves you, yeah, 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 that's $1,000 right there. You know the words, it'll be easy. Like I said, this is made out, this check here is made out to the Beatles. You divide it any way you want. You want to give Ringo less, that's up to you.
Let's get back to my interview with Lorne Michaels. Tom Shales says that although it's Saturday Night Live, you hate ad-libbing on the show. Why?
Yeah. Well, I like spontaneity. I just, you know, we're a written show. And because a lot of the people who appear on the show come from an improvisational background, I think the fantasy or the illusion was created somewhere in the 70s that it wasn't, you know, the people were making it up as they went along. But that's, you can't set camera angles and cuts without you know, a sort of real discipline, and that's a script, and it's a very strong writer's show, and people like Tina Fey, who's a, you know, an absolutely brilliant writer, is also a performer. You know, now can she, as she's going, if something happens that that she wasn't expecting, can she react to it and say something that hadn't been, you know, written? Absolutely. But by and large, what people are doing has been written, and the control room is sort of following that same script.
So many people on Saturday Night Live have gone on to not only be incredibly successful on the show, but to have incredible, you know, acting careers, movie careers afterwards. Mm-hmm. A few people who were on Saturday Night Live who had really incredible careers afterwards were almost invisible while they were on Saturday Night Live. And I'm thinking specifically of, like, Robert Downey Jr. I just, like, don't even remember him when he was on Saturday Night Live.
He was not, that was a very bumpy season. It was him and Anthony Michael Hall.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And Joan Cusack was in that group, too. No, it was a that was a cast that didn't gel. And the person responsible for it not gelling was me, because I made all the choices. But I think that Randy Quaid was in it as well. I think it was, you know, there were elements of that 1985 cast that ended up being part of the, you know, the following year I brought in Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks, and that group began to gel in a way that it hadn't in the 85 cast, 85, 86 cast.
Well, in that 85 cast, did you think, like, I lost it? I've lost my talent for picking
well,
people.
Well, no, I, yeah, it was a very tough time for me because, you know, I did the first 5 years and then I left. And then when they were going to cancel the show, Brandon Tartikoff asked me if I'd come back and do it. And that was a sort of difficult decision for me. And when it looked like it actually would be canceled, although I wouldn't have cared if it had been canceled in any of the years that between then, or if they'd canceled it when I left in 1980, I think I would have been all right with that too then. But somehow it turned out it mattered to me. So when I came back in, I still had sort of, you know, I'd forgotten so much how bruising it was, and I had very nice memories of what the first 5 years were like. And of course, what had been a very, you know, Saturday Night Dead appeared somewhere in the middle of the first season as a headline and never went away. And so suddenly to be beat up in 1985 by not having, you know, it be the golden years, which as I was living were not called the golden years. It took a while to find a new way of doing the show. And I think when Brandon was trying to get me to come back, he said, you know, like in the 70s, you had to be the center of everything, of every sort of creative decision. But, you know, you're older now and you have to learn how to delegate. And, you know, and once you can delegate and, you know, give authority to others and not be the center of things, then it would be much easier. And then at the end of the 85 season, he said, you can't delegate anything. You have to, you have to be, and so I went back into it in a different way, and it worked out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorne Michaels, and he's the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is now celebrating its 30th year on the air. There's something I really want to ask you, and this yeah. is kind of under the category, but enough about you. What about me?
Uh-huh. Sure.
There was a sketch on Saturday Night Live that involved a public radio cooking show, and one of the hosts mm-hmm. was named Terry. And some yeah. people, including members of my own family, have said to me, uh-huh. "Is that sketch have anything to do with you?" And I say, "No, it has absolutely nothing to do with me." But let me ask you: do you know the origins of where, like,
well,
what inspired that sketch?
When it was Anna and Molly, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was just the, I think they were playing with the dryness of, and the, you know, cheerfulness of a certain kind of approach to what was, I don't know, I don't want to speak for them. I think they were just fooling around and that, and I think it was meant in a complimentary way.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I don't think you're going to get much more out of me on that. But I think that, as with all things, it's, you know, part of it's drawn from something they experienced or thought they could play.
Okay.
And then after that, it, you know, by the time it reached Alec Baldwin and Shweta Balls, yeah, it was a completely different kind of piece than where it started at the beginning. So I think, right. Yeah.
Just one more thing. Did you ever want to be a full-time performer yourself as opposed to like the behind-the-scenes guy? You've been on Saturday Night Live as yourself many times.
Yeah, no, and in the show I did in Canada, I was a performer. And I think when I was college, I was in a bunch of plays. And occasionally I would look over at the person who was talking to me on stage, and I'd realize they actually were that character. Which was kind of, I thought, oh my God, they're completely lost in, they're not, you know, they are that person. I could never go that deeply, that deep. So I thought at best I could be, you know, okay. I didn't think I could be great at it. But, and I was more and more drawn, when I used to watch the show I did in Canada, I'd be in the editing room editing myself, and I'd see myself before the slate. And I'd see myself looking around, checking lighting and looking at camera angles and all that. And then the slate would happen, and then there'd be a big smile on my face that suddenly happened. And I thought, I'm not a natural at this. And I think that's fairly evident with today's interview. But I think...
Well, you're not comfortable talking?
I like to perform, and I love being around performers, and I love... being around people are funny.
Lorne Michaels, congratulations.
So I have a good job is my point, yeah.
Yeah, congratulations on 30 years of Saturday Night Live.
Thank you.
Incredible story. You've done incredible work. Thank you for talking with us about some of it.
Okay.
Lorne Michaels is the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live. Tonight, public television will broadcast the Kennedy Center tribute to him, at which he was given the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Coming up, the perfect food, pizza. This is Fresh Air. Food writer Ed Levine describes pizza as the perfect food, so he doesn't seem to have minded doing the research for his new book, Pizza, A Slice of Heaven. It tells the history of pizza, collects recipes, and also collects essays by many food critics discussing the burning issues surrounding pizza. Levine is also the author of New York Eats and contributes to the New York Times dining pages. He says there are many reasons why pizza is the perfect food.
It's the ultimate communal eating experience, right? When you think about it, it's the food that we grew up with, that sort of emancipated us from our parents, right? I don't know about you, but the first time I ever ate away from home by myself with my friends was a slice of pizza.
You know, I've never thought of that before, but that is so true because
Right? Where
I grew up in Brooklyn, there were pizza places. There were like three great pizza places within two blocks. So even as a child, I could walk with a friend to one of the pizza places and have lunch on our own.
And you were free at last. You know, you were free at last. And you had two slices and a soda. And at the time,
absolutely.
I don't know how old you are, but, you know, for me, I'm 53. The earliest memories I have of two slices and a soda, the slices were 15 cents and the soda was a dime. So for 70 cents, and you could even leave a really generous tip of 30 cents, you'd be at a dollar.
Now
that's a pretty... That's a pretty fulfilling and cheap meal.
Let's define our terms when we're talking about perfection. What kind of crust do you like?
I like a crust that is made with either yeast, sourdough starter, salt, flour, water. Pizza crust is at its heart great bread, right? So it should be the same things that go into great bread. And I like a crust that has a veneer of crispness that gives way to tender sort of internal bread dough. So, you know, you like that first bite, you want to hit a little bit of crispness, and then you want it to be tender. The same way when you bite into a great baguette or a perfect piece of rye bread.
And what about the surface, the cheese? What makes perfection there?
I like discrete areas of cheese and sauce. I like the mozzarella to be fresh mozzarella, so it should look white. It shouldn't be yellow. That aged mozzarella, that creepy yellow that aged mozzarella is, I don't like on pizza. So, and then I like sort of bubbles. I like the dough when it's cooked in a very hot oven that's either fueled with wood or charcoal. I like bubbles. You know those little bubbles that you find in bread or on the outside of pizza crust. I like those. You know, it means the pizza's going to be crisp. It means that pizza's going to be light. And I don't like the space blanket school of pizza cheese, you know, like the raised pizza, you know, where they put a half a pound of that weird cheese that's, you know, that's a color not found in nature. I don't like that.
And what about the sauce? What makes a good sauce?
My favorite kind of pizza sauce is as they serve it in Naples, which is merely canned, strained, fresh tomatoes, preferably from Italy, from San Marzano. But I've also had great California tomatoes. And I don't want it to be cooked, and I don't necessarily even want any seasoning in it. I like the taste of tomato, of simple tomato. I don't want it to taste like a pasta sauce. If you cook the sauce that you put on the pizza, then it tends to taste like a pasta sauce. And I like the simplicity of simple, canned, strained tomatoes.
Most places do use the pasta sauce, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It varies. It varies. A lot of places use canned pizza sauce, also not a good thing. And most of the canned pizza sauces are cooked. It's more forgiving. I'm sure it has a longer shelf life. Some of the serious sort of artisanal pizza makers will use a cooked tomato sauce on their Sicilian-style pizza and a fresh tomato sauce on their Neapolitan-style pizza.
You know how a lot of pizza makers, and this is particularly true in the good old-fashioned pizzerias, they'll take the dough and they'll toss it and twirl it in the air and they never drop it. What does that do for the pizza dough?
You know, I'm not sure because I'm not a practiced bread baker, but most of the serious pizzaiola I know say that you don't really have to toss the dough. I think it's to stretch the dough and to stretch it in an even way. But I also think it became part, you know, theater for all the pizzaiola in the country that could that had an open space where they could, you know, where they could toss the dough.
Of course, so many restaurants serve those individual sized pizzas now, and you can't very well toss those in the air. They're too small.
No, exactly. And that's why in Naples, where pizza in this culture was born in the 1830s, you never see them tossing because they only make one size of pizza. They only make the individual sized pizza. And this whole thing about larger pizzas only came into being when pizza moved to America.
You know, a lot of restaurants brag now that they have a brick oven for their pizza. What does the brick oven get you?
Well, the brick oven reflects heat really well and allows heat to build up and stay at a constant temperature. So it can be brick. It can be many other kinds of stone. Actually, the key thing is that it be brick or stone, and that it, you know, because even in gas-fired pizza ovens, they have stone linings or stone on the bottom. And of course, when we reheat pizza or make pizza at home, we use what is known as a pizza stone. And so it's what's important is that it be stone or brick. Brick happens to be a particularly effective heat transmitter and a holder of heat. But it doesn't necessarily have to be brick. All kinds of stone can be used.
So a gas oven with stone in it is good.
Yeah, is better than a gas oven without stone. The key to the oven is how hot you can get that oven and whether you can maintain that heat. In other words, the reason we can't make great pizza at home is because our ovens only go up to 550 degrees. In a wood-burning pizza oven in Naples or in this country or in a coal-fired brick oven, which is where all the seminal pizzerias in America used in New York and New Haven and all these other places, the coal-fired brick ovens and the wood-fired brick ovens get to 1,000 degrees. So the reason you can't make great pizza at home is because we can't get the ovens hot enough.
I have one last very important question for you, which is, do you always eat the crust, the rim. Some people like leave that over.
I know, but I think if it's good, that great pizza crust, like at the pizzerias I love, I couldn't bear to leave the crust. The Neapolitans, interestingly enough, because they eat pizza with a knife and fork, because they don't cut the pizza in Naples, so they often leave the outer rim, which is called the cornicione, and they don't eat it. They just eat the inner parts of the pizza. But I think that if it's a great pizza, that the crust deserves to be eaten in full.
Ed Levine, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Ed Levine is the author of the new book, Pizza, A Slice of Heaven. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on the end of NYPD Blue and the new season of Deadwood. Two shows created by David Milch. This is Fresh Air. Last night, NYPD Blue ended its run after 12 years on ABC. This weekend, the HBO Western series Deadwood begins its second season. TV critic David Bianculli says the two shows have a lot more in common than pushing the boundaries of sex, nudity, violence, and language.
What do you got?
Looks to be like a high-priced call girl.
Yeah, the doorman called in the job. Billy Manager's on his way in.
What are you doing out of uniform?
Talk to building management, find out who's paying her rent.
They're not in yet. You know, I thought once we cleared Bell's shooting, you were going to go back to patrol.
Tell him already.
Chief of detectives gave me the squad.
When?
Last night at Metavoice Racket.
You didn't say anything there?
I wanted to make sure that Duffy didn't change his mind, and I didn't want to take away from Metavoice night.
A message came through this morning that it was a done deal.
Wait, so you're actually squad commander?
Yep.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Gruden.
Not sure I can work with you.
No, huh?
I'm not sure any of us can.
Well, that'll work out good then, because I was planning on bringing in my own people anyways.
That's Dennis Franz as Andy Sipowicz, the one actor and character who was in every episode of NYPD Blue at the beginning of last night's finale. He's just shown up at a crime scene and is almost shyly informing his co-workers that he's just been promoted to precinct commander. It's an amazing journey that Andy Sipowicz covered since NYPD Blue premiered in 1993. When we met him, he was a mess, a racist, a drunk, and on a self-destructive streak that came within an inch of killing him. And that was all in the pilot episode. NYPD Blue was co-created by Stephen Bochco and David Milch. Bochco also was one of the primary forces behind an earlier landmark police drama, Hill Street Blues, which also had at its center a recovering alcoholic with a badge. But that character, Daniel J. Travanti's Frank Farrillo, was in charge from the start and ran his precinct as crisply as he dressed. Whatever his demons were, he had conquered them long ago. He wasn't tempted by drink. He carried on an affair with a defense attorney played by Veronica Hamill. And he was one of the first leading characters on a primetime cop show who actually took time out to pray, to visit church, even to seek confession. Sipowicz on NYPD Blue was a very different animal. For him, sobriety, tolerance, and personal growth came slowly. But come they did, and viewers loved him for both his vulnerability and his persistence. Last night's finale had him taking command and walking that tricky tightrope of having a bit more power and responsibility than your friends and peers, but still having to deal with, and sometimes fight with, the powers above you. Andy Sipowicz ended where Frank Farrillo began, with the respect of those under him, but not those above him. It's a nice full-circle story arc, and it's also a familiar one. On Deadwood, the HBO Western series beginning its second season this Sunday, central character Seth Bullock, played by Timothy Oliphant, is pretty much in the same place. Cop shows often are deconstructed as modern westerns, and Deadwood makes it easy to track the comparisons. There's as much lawlessness in isolated Deadwood as in Lower Manhattan, and town sheriff Seth Bullock, like squad commander Andy Sipowicz, accepted his position of authority recently and reluctantly. And where Andy fought with the powers that be last night on a political level, Sunday's season opener of Deadwood has Seth prepared to fight his powers that be on a more literal level. In this case, it's the town's most powerful figure, Ian McShane's imposing, tough-talking Al Swearengen. Swearengen has insulted the sheriff by publicly ridiculing his private affair with the wealthy town widow. Insults Swearengen continues to hurl privately once Seth shows up at Swearengen's room to pick a fight. Swearengen is talking about outside interests trying to influence and take over the Deadwood mining town, but Seth is more interested in removing his gun and badge and throwing some punches.
How do you have this information?
From the governor himself in a pricey little personal note. They want to make us a trough for Yankton snouts and them hoople heads out there. They need buttressing against going over to those. Now, I can handle my areas, but there's dimensions and angles I'm not expert at. You would be if you'd sheathe your long enough.
Shut up.
And resume being the upright pain in the balls that graced us all last summer.
Shut up, you son of a bitch.
Jesus Christ. Bullock. The world abounds in of every kind, including hers. Of course. If it'd steer you from something stupid, I could always profess another position.
Well, I find you've got a knife.
I won't need no f***ing knife.
The major link between Deadwood and NYPD Blue, of course, is David Milch, who co-created Blue and is the sole creator of Deadwood. In 1993, long before cable's Oz and the Sopranos, ABC's NYPD Blue was as bold as TV got. Today, Deadwood, with its adult themes, brazenly coarse language, and complicated characters and plots, can make the same claim. Milch left NYPD Blue a few seasons before it ended, but it's impossible to imagine Deadwood without him. And you thought Andy Sipowicz had his demons? Check out Seth, who has so much darkness battling with his essential decency that he's almost as much villain as hero. In the same way, despite so many despicable traits and acts, Al Swearengen is almost a noble villain. Deadwood is no white hat, black hat western. Everything and everyone is painted with shades of gray. In Sunday's season premiere, there's a moment when all the simmering emotions, especially the lust and the anger, come to a head. When the violence erupts, it happens suddenly and shockingly, and it matters. As on NYPD Blue, change occurs slowly and actions have ramifications. It's a stunningly written and stunningly performed series. Easily one of the best on all of television.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by the British invasion band The Searchers. The band's drummer, Chris Curtis, died Monday at the age of 63. This record was a big hit in the U.S. in 1964.
I loved, and I knew I had to run away, get down on my knees and pray that they'd go away, but still they began. Needles and pins, because of all my pride, the tears I gotta hide. Hey, I thought I was smart, I wanted hard. Didn't think I'd do, but now I see she's worse to him than me. Let her go ahead, take his love instead, and one day she will see just how to say please and get down on her knees. Hey, that's how it begins.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from Delacorte, publisher of Alternate Atlanta, a novel about a young man coming to terms with love, relationships, and familial obligations by Marshall Boswell. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Al-Qaeda isn't the only Islamic terrorist group with cells in the U.S. Hezbollah has cells in about 14 American cities. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Barbara Newman and Tom Diaz about their new book, Lightning Out of Lebanon, Hezbollah Terrorists on American Soil. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.